Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. On today's episode, we feature four retina-related projects presented at the 2017 Residence Day Research Conference at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. We have representative of each residency class discussing their research, as well as one of our retina fellows. Remember that you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. All 52 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal, Rounded, Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. If you enjoy the podcast, you will enjoy our blog, which will feature weekly posts from myself and the show's producer, Louis Kai. My most recent post went up yesterday talking about the attributes of successful ophthalmology residents. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page. You can find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store or Google Play. We are on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. And to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Those positive reviews will help us as we continue to grow and expand our scope. Some bookkeeping notes. Originally, Dr. Matt Weed and I were planning to have an episode out this week reviewing common maculopathies. That's been rescheduled for next week. The retinas took priority last weekend, so we're pushing that back. We also will have a pre-fellowship Q&A session coming up. So if you are entering a vitreoretinal fellow, that will be a can't miss. Now, here's our first speaker. I'm here with Dr. John Hinkle. John is a first-year resident here at the Bascom-Palmer Institute, and he's here to talk about his residency day project. John, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell me, what was the title of your project?
So it's kind of a cumbersome title. We were looking at factors that predict follow-up after emergency room visits in proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
So how did you kind of design this study? What was kind of your period you looked at?
So we looked at the period at which Bascom had the electronic medical record. So that started actually in May of 2014. And then we looked at records up through December of last year, 2016.
And about how many patients did you capture?
So we ended up with approximately, I actually have the exact number here, 616 encounters, which were 448 individual patients.
And these are all patients with a diagnosis coded for proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
Yeah. So there were more patients gathered with searching for that query, but we went back through and eliminated patients whose chief complaint or whose active problems didn't include proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
So what percentage of these patients actually come back for follow-up?
So we looked at their immediate follow-up visit. So this data doesn't include anything, you know, whether or not they came to the subsequent two or three or four. But we found that around 60% of patients who were seen in the ER for active proliferative disease attended their follow-up appointment.
What factors kind of predict which patients are going to follow up, which ones don't? Because that's a pretty big percentage. It's 40% of them aren't coming back.
Yeah. And so we looked at a lot of different demographic data, race, ethnicity. We even looked at zip code distance from the Eye Institute. We looked at median income of those zip codes at which they lived. And none of the demographic data was really predictive of whether or not they would come back or not. However, in looking at some of the visit characteristics, as we termed them, there were some predictive variables. One was type of insurance. The Public Health Trust Program actually had a high rate of return for those patients coming back to their follow-up appointments, whereas Medicaid had a much lower rate of return, and there were some private insurances that also had lower rates.
How did you factor in, so, and maybe you couldn't, but situations where either the patient maybe followed up outside, you don't know, or maybe the insurance isn't contracted at the hospital and they sent it to come. Were there ways to tease that out?
So we haven't done an excellent job of teasing that out, I wouldn't say. What we did do was, as we were going through the notes from that ER visit, if it was explicitly stated in the note that the patient had an outside provider and they were going to follow up with them, that didn't count as not following up. If they explicitly stated that it was a non-contracted insurance, would need follow-up outside, that didn't count as follow-up, or as not following up. So we tried to exclude patients who we knew were had those barriers to coming back.
Now, in terms of what you take from this going forward, obviously you could still continue the study, you could redesign, you can make a bigger sample size or apply it to other diagnoses, but what are kind of your take-home points? We know that proliferative diabetic retinopathy is important for these patients to follow up because they not only have to be compliant with their eye appointments, some compliance with their eye appointments a lot of times correlated with poor compliance with medical appointments. And so what sort of things, did you see anything that we can do differently to increase the odds that someone will come back or to predict that someone won't come back?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's certainly the main goal is to translate this into something that when you see a patient, they are accessing medical care, change things about how you approach that visit or approach subsequent visits so that they will continue to get that medical care. Two other things that we saw were shorter visits in the ER seemed to suggest that people would come back, and also a shorter time period to that follow-up appointment also seemed to suggest that those patients were more likely to follow up.
Meaning that if you gave them an appointment for a week versus a month, maybe what you've said to them about the importance of the visit sticks more when they decide to come in. Maybe the date just slips their mind. Maybe think life just life happens and they forget about it.
Exactly.
So maybe if you keep the follow-up a little more tight in those settings, people kind of understand the gravity a little more.
And I think, proliferative patients kind of have demonstrated that there are barriers for them getting care. And so maybe a good way to think about it is when things have aligned such that they do access care, it's important to make it as easy and as kind of urgent as possible for them to continue to do that. And so even if you treat them in the ER and they might not need a really quick follow-up, it might be a good idea to do that just so you can check in, make sure that they're doing well, and continue to kind of help manage that disease.
Right. And so even though eye emergency rooms are pretty uncommon, there's only a handful in the country, so this isn't necessarily a super applicable population. It does, again, raise interesting points about what sort of treatment would be best for these patients, whether there's always a debate about anti-VEGF therapy versus laser versus, maybe in the future be other pharmacologic agents we can use. But again, if compliance and follow-up is an issue, then maybe you're more likely to, even in our setting, maybe perform laser if it's necessary in those settings.
Exactly. And we looked at whether or not treatment in that emergency room visit either helped or hindered following up, and it didn't seem to have any association. And so given that, by and large, these patients are less likely to come back, it might behoove the provider to provide as much treatment as they can when the patients are in the medical setting.
Well, John, thanks for your time, and thank you for sharing your research with us.
My pleasure.
I'm here with Dr. Nikisha Kothari. She is a graduating third-year resident at Bascom-Palmer, and she is literally on the way out the door. She's flying to Los Angeles this evening. You start your retina fellowship in 2 weeks at UCLA, and she's here to tell us about her residence day project. So what was the title of your residence day project?
The title of our residence day project was a multi-center study looking at the surgical outcomes of pediatric macular holes.
And what was your design in terms of CAPS? Is this a retrospective study?
Correct, yeah. It's a retrospective study. There's not a lot of patients with pediatric macular holes, so we decided to include multiple institutions to try to get a better sense of what kind of preoperative factors were predictive for good surgical outcomes and visual acuity outcomes. It's a retrospective study.
And what did you guys find? What were the outcomes like?
So we looked at OCT, size of the macular hole preoperatively. And interestingly, we found that the size of the hole didn't correlate quite as much as we would have expected. with the final visual acuity outcome. The base of the size of the macular hole did correlate, but again, it wasn't a strong correlation. More likely was the preoperative visual acuity mm-hmm. correlation with the postoperative visual acuity.
What was the closure rate like?
The closure rate was 90.4%, so very, very high. And of course, the one that didn't close, or the few that didn't close, were chronic holes.
Okay. And were the majority of these traumatic?
Yeah, the majority of these were traumatic. Actually, all of the cases were traumatic. You know, that's the thought is it's from some kind of blunt trauma mm-hmm. That causes the hole to form.
You know, those are kind of tricky cases, and I think one of the reasons they're tricky, the hyoid's down a lot of the times, and it can be hard to lift some of these younger patients. What was kind of the youngest patient in your series?
So the youngest patient was actually 6 months, and per the history, there was no known history of non-accidental trauma to suggest shaken baby, because we did exclude shaken baby cases. It was some kind of ball that had hit the eye. And this patient didn't do quite as well. Obviously, you know, the thing to think about in kids too is amblyopia, and that tends to impact outcomes. So that's, you know, and a lot of these too have other things such as vitreous hemorrhage, commotio, hyphemas, you know, glaucoma, that could be limiting their vision in addition to the macular hole.
Still, 90% closure rate is good. I mean, it's really good for these holes. What was the technique similar for all these cases? Were they all just vitrectomy, broad ILM peel, gas, long-acting gas, short-acting gas?
So we kind of had a spread of everything. 23-gauge was the most commonly used, although we did have two cases of 27-gauge. Included. As far as gas, C3F8 was the most common, but SF6, oil, and air were also used. And, you know, one of the things we have to think about in kids is face-down positioning, which becomes challenging. And then regarding ILM peeling, it was really up to the surgeon, but the majority did have an ILM peel at the time of surgery. And staining varied, again, based on the preference from ICG to no stain to brilliant blue in one case.
Any factors that you found that influenced hole closure?
You know, so I looked at the time from presentation to the time of surgery. A lot of these close spontaneously. And so timing, it seems to be important to decide whether to, you know, when to intervene.
Right.
It didn't seem that if you waited longer that they had poor outcomes. So it seems reasonable to wait, and some people will suggest 3 to 6 months. In our study, the average time was about 3 months from time of presentation to surgery.
Awesome. Well, great job. This is officially your last project of residency. How does it feel? You're done. You were here, undergraduate. You stayed for intern year, or you went home?
I went to Philly for intern year, but I moved here in 2006, so it's been
almost 11 years.
11 years, yeah, so it's kind of an end of an era.
We have residents who listen, some medical students, not many, but anything that you had a final word, you know, anything that you felt, if you had one lesson you took from residency that you wanted to pass on to yourself when back in 2014 when you started residency that you wish you had known?
That's a tough one. I think, you know, at the end of the day, we all do research, we're all advancing our careers, but ultimately I think, you know, treating your patients the way you would want to treat your mom or your grandmother or any family member always, I think, comes back to you in a great way. And I think now closing out my time at Bascom, I can really see after 3 years of following the same patients that it's really meaningful to develop these relationships and value that, which sometimes we miss when we're starting first year and kind of overwhelmed with just learning ophthalmology.
Well, Nikki, thank you for your time. Safe flight, safe travels. We'll miss you, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jay.
I'm here with Dr. Andrew Rong. Andrew is a second-year resident at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute, and he's here to tell us about his residence day project. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Sridhar.
Andrew, what was the title of your talk? The
title of my talk was, Can We Predict Neovascular Glaucoma in Central Retinal Vein Occlusions Through a Retrospective Analysis?
So how did you conduct this study? What was your kind of method of collecting these patients?
So I looked at all the central retinal vein occlusions that presented to Bascom Palmer in 2015, 2016, and 2017. The symptoms had to be have had an onset of less than 90 days, and there must have been an absence of anterior segment neovascularization on their presentation.
And these were patients who also who had not been treated with anti-VEGF previously.
Correct. They could not have had anti-VEGF injections prior to their presentation.
So how many patients did you screen and how many patients did you end up with?
I looked over the first 2 years of the what I looked at, we looked at 361 charts and about 89 patients met that inclusion criteria.
And how many of these cases ended up developing neovascular glaucoma?
There were 11 out of 89 cases, or about 12% of the patients developed neovascular glaucoma.
So what were the risk factors you identified for patients to develop into neovascular glaucoma?
So interestingly, we looked at a wide variety of risk factors, hypertension, diabetes, etc., as well as what Dr. Hayray looks at, afferent pupillary defect, as well as open-angle glaucoma, etc. What we found was that one of the best predictors, just like what Dr. Hayray shows, is that afferent pupillary defect is one of the higher risk factors for us developing neovascular glaucoma in central retinal vein occlusion.
Anything else that was kind of significant in separating patients out?
Yeah, so what we also were able to see was that open-angle glaucoma, having a history of that, a lot of the patients who developed neovascular glaucoma had a history of this, and that's been actually shown by Dr. Hayray as well in some of his studies. Interestingly enough, hypertension and diabetes, as well as BMI, sex, age, did not seem to correlate with the development of neovascular glaucoma. We didn't look at things like fluorescein angiography or ERG, such as that indicated in the CVOS study, or that indicated in Hayray's natural history studies, because we thought that in a lot of these patients who come through Bascom Palmer, some of the, they don't get a fluorescein angiography or ERG on right. presentation.
So is, I mean, the retrospective kind of nature prevents you from getting all the information you maybe want on those patients.
Correct. So, you know, we again, what we really found was that afferent pupillary defect and the history of glaucoma were the risk factors that seemed to predict if a patient was to get neovascular glaucoma.
Did age play any role?
It didn't seem to be. Of course, our study is limited by retrospective nature as well as its small sample size mm-hmm. currently, but it did not appear to have a role. Interestingly enough, although age did not have a role in neovascular glaucoma, it did appear that the patients who were aged less than 50 did very well compared to those who were age greater than 50.
And that's within patients with NVG or all patients with CRVG you looked at?
I looked at all the patients who were age less than 50, and the N was about 15. Mm-hmm. And those patients presenting with a central retinal vein occlusion did not have neovascular glaucoma, and their vision almost always went to about 20/20 to 20/30 with either zero or one intravitreal Avastin injection.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what do you take forward from this study? So this is a study that confirmed in a really nice fashion a lot of the things Dr. Hayray has written about in the past, the afferent pupillary defect, the presence of glaucoma as being risk factors for NVG. So retrospective analyses can only take you so far, but what sort of future studies or future ideas does this give you about the most important question, which is your question initially, can you predict which patients actually get neovascular glaucoma when they present?
So that's a great question. Right now, we need to look at more years of data. We need mm-hmm. to increase our N. Dr. Hayray separated the two groups into non-ischemic versus ischemic based off his algorithm. As I said previously, it's very difficult to predict this because of its retrospective analysis. We can't put our patients into this ischemic and non-ischemic group based off his algorithm, mm-hmm. nor can we do it based off the CVOS algorithm. So, you know, it's the best way for us to predict if we want to see what's the best treatment for it. Ultimately, we want to see what intervention can we perform as to prevent this subgroup of patients from ultimately developing neovascular glaucoma. And one of the main questions is whether PRP in this higher risk group of patients will actually prevent neovascular glaucoma. We know that through the RAVE trial, that even if we inject patients with Avastin, or with actually Lucentis, I believe, that the patients still will develop neovascularization.
Right. So the study you referenced was the RAVE trial out of Texas, where they essentially injected patients once a month who presented with neovascularization in the anterior segment and a vein occlusion. I think it was 9 months of injections, I think.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And then a substantial proportion, I think it was like 75% of them, had recurrence of their neovascularization very soon after stopping injections, I think within 3 months.
Correct.
So your argument would be, or maybe the possibility is, these are the patients we have to identify and get pan-retinal laser and PRP laser in very early.
Correct. That's something that we may want to look at. It's just, you know, I feel like the main reason for this study is we have such a high morbidity for a lot of these central retinal vein occlusions, and we just don't have a great way of preventing it currently other than observing them until they develop neovascularization.
True, and we don't have a good algorithm for when they come off anti-VEGF treatment. If they do come off, or even when we're extending them, if you start treating extending someone for the macular edema, we don't know whether during that extension period, whether you stopped therapy, if they're going to get neovascularization. They would have gotten months before we had initiated therapy.
Correct, correct.
So, great job, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm here with Dr. Steven Ryder. Dr. Ryder is a second-year vitreoretinal surgical fellow here at Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute, graduating in 2 weeks.
That's right.
Two weeks. And then heading up to North Carolina to start his practice as a member of the Horizon Eye Group. Already got a website and a picture with your
Nothing
coming
like
soon.
Your website.
You start in August?
I start August 14th, that's right.
Okay, great. Well, tell us a little bit about your project, Steve. What was the title of your project?
The title of my project is The Application of the Newer OCT Modalities in the Management of Macular Hole Surgery. And it's a project that started from the beginning of my fellowship. It's a case Dr. Townsend and I had early on. And we have the benefit of having great imaging here at Bascom. And one of the modalities we have is intraoperative OCT. So he recorded this case and used OCT to show that the hole was closing after ILM peeling. And so we have wonderful pictures and then OCT slices from the OR. But then we also took angio a week later. And we saw on the on-foss slabs that it exactly mirrors what you see in terms of the ILM peel. You can actually see the area that's peeled on the on-foss slab. And I thought it was really cool.
Now, when you say it was closing, it was before you went to air, you could see that the hole was closing already?
Correct. Under fluid, you could see that the hole, the tips of the hole were already pointed in, and it was closing.
Okay. Which goes along with, people have talked about this whole idea of the traction, the traction from the ILM, so that goes along with why we peel, or why people recognize that peeling the ILM was helpful.
Exactly.
So tell me, what was your study kind of design?
So the design was basically a prospective observational study for patients undergoing mac hole repair. And they would hopefully pre- and post-op receive OCT angio and on-foss imaging. It ended up being mostly a post-op analysis. I don't have a complete set of the 10 patients that we obtained. But we would use the OCT prior, the standard Zeiss in this case for most patients, measure the distance of the ISOS defect, measure the visual acuity, their lens status, and then postoperatively use the on-foss images to measure, again with the ruler image, the width of the ILM peel, and especially the temporal radius. And then we looked at sort of the size of the ISO defect and how that correlated with the ILM peel, and then the post-op visual acuity. We were lucky that all 10 cases closed,
mm-hmm.
And thank you for contributing a case.
One for one, baby.
It's interesting to note that obviously this is very subjective to the surgeon's bias and how large they wanted to peel. We weren't going for standardized measurements, but clearly the larger the ISO defect, the more the ILM was peeled. But it's nice to quantify the size of the ILM. The studies out there that talk about ILM peeling, they don't, as far as I can tell, show quantitatively.
It's hard.
The diameter or the radius of the ILM peel.
They always just say broad-based to the arcades or whatever, yeah.
Correct. And so, and not that I'm advocating at this point that we have a certain cutoff, but it's nice to understand, unfortunately I'll have more cases in the future where holes that won't close, mm-hmm. to see maybe
that temporal edge, that temporal radius needs to go further out. So it's something that people have kind of mentioned orally, mm-hmm. and I think that it'd be nice to sort of show that perhaps you need to go a certain distance
right.
or sort of pay attention to the temporal radius of your ILM peel.
Mm-hmm.
But Mac hole surgery is so interesting because there's so many things that you can change about it. And Dr.
Right.
Albini always cites, even with just vitrectomy, removing the posterior hyoid, you have a great success rate.
Yeah.
And so now we've done these additional steps that we don't really know if they're necessary.
Right.
And in my talk, I talked about the folks from Iowa doing the ILM abrasion technique. Maybe you don't need to peel it. And we know about the damage that happens with ILM peeling, the tram tracking of the RNFL. You can see those. I think microperimetry is shown to be effective as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's damage there. And so it clearly isn't a benign procedure. In fact, there's real damage. So do we need to do it? How much? Maybe just the larger holes need to be peeled, maybe not the smaller ones. It'd
right.
be nice to quantify it. My study was 10 patients. They all closed. And good visual acuity at month one.
What
also
was the average hole size, more or less? Like, were these?
These are on average 630 microns.
It's not tiny.
Yeah. And I had the breakdown was two stage two, smaller than 400, four stage three, and then six were, or five were, four, sorry, four were stage four. So altogether, kind of a good mix. It'd be nice in the future to select those out for maybe just the larger ones and
right,
see how
right.
the ILM peel does. So, but again, just the whole complexity there's so many different parts to the Mac hole surgery, I think, that you can change. It'd be nice to know maybe exactly what we need to do. And I didn't even talk about positioning. We here at Bascom, I think for the most part, face down position for at least 3 days, and most folks do 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
But again, maybe those smaller holes don't need to be positioned or ILM peeled.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice to, something that one of your frequent guests, Dr. Kurian, and I talked about my first year. How many of those steps of Mac hole surgery do you need to do? You don't
right,
need to do 100% of them, maybe.
Well,
maybe you do eight of them.
And it's true of every surgery, right? And
yeah.
I think it's interesting, you go through, you talk to any centennials who've been out of practice, regardless of your retinal attachment, Mac hole, or whatever, you go through evolutions of how much you do.
Right.
And everyone evolves differently. Like, I feel like I'm doing more doing certain surgeries than I did towards the end of my fellowship. And I don't know how much of that is the desire for certainty. And maybe you're not actually making things more certain. You're just giving yourself the illusion of control, which makes you feel better. But, you know, I think you could take every single Mac hole. You could peel the ILM as broad as you can beyond the arcades.
Yeah.
You could put C3F8 in, and you're going to face down for 2 weeks. And you know what? Those holes would probably close. The question is that all necessary, right? Did you have to do every one of those steps for every single one of those holes, like you said? And we don't know. And some people it's easier for them. The thought process is like, I don't even want to worry. I don't want to deal with the fact that it may not work. But the question is your number needed to treat, right?
Yeah.
How many patients need to be face down for X amount of time to get one patient who wouldn't have closed to close?
Right.
How many patients do you need? And what is the relative value of that, not only to you as the surgeon, but to them as the patient? And that's really hard to measure, especially when there's so many different techniques.
Yes, exactly. And all those things, face down positioning is not a benign thing.
It's not.
Residency,
it's the worst.
I remember hearing about a patient who had a DVT who was in prone positioning for days on end, thinking that they were doing service to their eye. And they were, and yet they were stagnant. And these are older folks, too. It's not a pleasant position. So if we can figure out the right metric
mm-hmm.
for ILM peel, for positioning, sort of knowing what numbers are important, that'd be nice.
Yeah, and like you said, intraoperative OCT is not, I think, an evolving technology. I think the two things that, based on your study, that I'm interested to see going forward is, at some point, and maybe it's already available, I don't know, if intraoperative OCT could give you an on-foss, like, real-time measurement, right?
That's
so you could
point.
Actually, you know, you can estimate how much you peel, because you can look at the nerve and be like, the nerve is 1,500 microns, so this is how much I'm peeling. But if it could actually tell you as you're peeling, like, your diameter around the hole is X microns, then you can actually quantify for research,
right.
Like, we peeled X amount.
You can take the image and then use a ruler software after.
Right. But I'm talking about it tells you in real time what you're doing.
But we often do that just based on the nerve size too, right?
We estimate.
I'm going 2 distameters temporal.
And it's interesting you said the smaller holes were peeled less and the larger holes more. Maybe that was intentional, but part of that might be when you're looking at it with a smaller hole,
less broad peel still looks pretty broad because the hole's so small. You know what I'm saying?
The hole size,
there's some optical illusion there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't. That's a really interesting study idea and design.
The Onfosh just blows me away because the cool thing I didn't mention was that 7 months out, you could even see the area of island that was peeled. I was worried that this was just a temporary effect of maybe hyperreflectivity because all these folks got ICG stained too.
Yeah.
Maybe there was some effect with the inner retina, maybe a toxic effect, transiently.
Yeah.
That caused the disparity between the ILM and the RNFL, and so. But you could see it 7 months out. You could see exactly based on the Onfos imaging where it was peeled. So it's cool to know this is potentially a sustainable thing. I extrapolated in my talk saying, for those holes that don't close or the holes that open up again. To know how much ILM you have, kind of as a surgical plan. You can use the pedicle, the ILM flap. You can. There's different things that are being developed now, but it's sort of nice, I think, preoperatively to know exactly what your plan is and to know what's available with the ILM. Because, again, we know that ICG is potentially toxic to the macula. So if you don't need to stain right in the macula, there's no ILM there. So maybe you can just stain temporally and get your ILM pedicle or your ILM flap and bring it over. So I think there's little nuances that are potentially helpful in the future.
Well, strong work. Thank you. Excited for your practice?
Very excited, man. Yeah. We're actually moving out tomorrow. I'm glad this is on radio and not video because I haven't shaved. My wife is leaving. And so.
Not leaving you permanently.
No, just moving back to North Carolina. All right, good. And so we are, we're excited, man. Things are moving in the right direction. We're happy.
Great. You know, you were going to be doing actually a pod at request of some listeners with a couple of first-year fellows who are finishing this year about tips for people entering fellowship. So you're finishing fellowship.
Yeah.
If you look back, and that's
many years ago.
Many, many moons ago, and now compared to what you know now.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me one thing that you thought was important that was not important going in, and one thing you wish you had known that you didn't know going in that would have helped you going in.
Wow.
Hard, right?
Super hard. You always ask hard questions, actually.
It's okay. You can always change it. Maybe you knew. Maybe you didn't. Maybe there weren't any one great
thing I think that's hard
things
to,
that surprised you. Maybe you knew what you were getting into.
It's hard to know the value and the weight of remaining positive. There's ups and downs in fellowship, right?
Yeah.
So you know that you haven't mastered surgical techniques, and so I think it's easy to get frustrated, and you have to stay positive and always look to your mentors and say, you know, I know that technique wasn't perfect. Can you help me with that next time or talk me through that? So it's always, you know, don't reflect on what you've done poorly. You have to obviously learn from it, but you have to think positive and ask around for tips. I knew that going in, but you still have moments where you feel like, gosh, I just can't get that one step or, you know, lasering superiorly or peeling ILM, things that just sort of, you know, take time, but also take patience to get. Other part was that
something that you thought was important, but ended up not being that important. That you were like stressed about, or you were worried about, and you're like, oh, actually, it wasn't that big a deal.
That's a tough one, because I don't know. It ebbs and flows so much.
Well, I'll give one to buy time. One thing I thought was oh, am I, you know. And this is a concern I think of anyone who's going to ophthalmology is, are my hands going to be good enough, right? And I remember one of my general surgery attendings, this was in when I was a medical student. I think I may have told you the story. He went up towards the end of the rotation, he stands in front of us, and he says, I just want you all to know you've done a great job in this rotation, and I hope you've learned that the most important part of being a good surgeon is not your hands. It's the decision-making you make and how you react when things don't go the way you expect it to go. But don't worry, you're sitting there thinking your hands aren't good enough and you can't be a surgeon, but you can be. And I'm sitting in that audience, I'm like, this guy is completely messing, you know, he's just, this is a total farce, right? People always say things like this, but it's very clear that certain people have great hands, some people don't, and most people are in the middle. And as a student, I was like, I'm not Ben Carson sitting there writing a book about my gifted hands, right? Like, that's not me. And then, you know, that was in the back of my mind, residency and fellowship. And honestly, now looking back, I actually agree. I think obviously it's going to be easier for certain people than others. Your hands are going to be important. You want to have steady hands. You want to have good control. But a lot of that is down to positioning and where you stabilize yourself and what angles you approach things at. And ultimately, it is really important the decisions you make, and not just the decisions you make in the operating room, but decision about when to take patients to surgery and when to tell a patient, hey, maybe we should wait on something. And that goes to your first point, which was about getting down on yourself. I think the biggest thing to fight in fellowship and beyond, and I fought throughout fellowship this year, is this concept known as surgeon's guilt. Mm-hmm. And there's a decent number of articles and literature about it in the general surgery literature.
I'm Catholic, so I know all about that.
Yeah, yeah. So, but they talk about this in general surgery literature because they deal with mortality, right? So
yeah.
They carry a huge weight on themselves all the time when things don't go well. And you can't let the guilt consume you. Obviously, like you said, you don't want to be making mistakes and not have insight into like, oh, I'm doing things wrong. I need to do things better for next time. But you also can't carry that albatross with you all the time because sometimes things don't go well because you did something not optimally. But sometimes things don't go well because they just don't go well.
That's right.
And if you let that eat away at yourself, that's when people burn out, I think. Is not from the it's not because it's actually probably the people who care the most who end up burning out.
Right.
Because you can't carry that and you can't carry that home with you when you're with your wife or your kids, and you have to at some point be positive, like you said, and just step back and be like, I did the very best I could, and maybe it wasn't good enough in this case, but would I have done anything differently once I take my emotions and everything step back? And that's when you kind of learn for the next time. But you just can't let that weigh you down once you start becoming the primary surgeon making the hard decisions.
Right. And I think a similar conclusion from that line of thinking is that you're not doing it yourself, too. You need the help of your support staff. In fellowship, you need your teachers to kind of coach you along. And you need to let people help you, guide you, reassure you, just like you do patients, you know? So you're not out there by yourself. So that's, you think that every day you show up to clinic, you're like, well, I'm going to just burn through this clinic. I'm going to do so fast. And I don't need anybody. I don't need any tech help. I don't need nursing help. And you realize that the better the team works, the better the patients do, the less stress you have. So I think that's it, that it's not just on you. You think fellowship is going to show up, they trust me to be this amazing doctor, and they trust me with their patients, and you want to do 100% of the work, and you shouldn't, and you can't. So it's nice to have a good support team.
Well, Steve, good luck.
Thanks
for being
very,
a loyal
very
listener. And
I love this podcast.
I pay him to say these things.
It's no, I know. I love it so much. And also when you have Ajay and Dan, you have awesome guests every week. It's so fun to listen.
Well, thanks for coming.
Thank
I'll talk
much.
To you soon, okay? Good luck, and good luck with the move.
Thanks, Jay.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Drs. Hinkle, Ron, Kotari, and Ryder for joining me. Thank you to Louis Kai for the great production as usual. Finally, thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.